Hello, I'm Joan. I'm a Canadian family physician who also works as a restorative medical educator, facilitator, and coach. I create spaces that rehumanize the work of healthcare. I'm creating this podcast to remind myself, as well as anyone else working in a helping profession, that when you are working and caring for your human patients, you are the other human in the room. Hello there, healthcare humans. Thank you as always for coming back for another episode of The Other Human in the Room. If you are watching the video of this, you'll notice I'm in a different room. I'm actually in my bedroom today because my husband is also working from home and he actually needs a desk and I don't, especially for this stuff. So just peep a different view. Isn't that fun for anyone who actually watches? How many people watch versus listen? I think most people listen. So this means nothing to you. Moving on. So this episode has been a long time coming. Excuse me. In the sense that I've had this idea for a podcast episode for such a long time that, to be honest, I thought I had already made it. And then I looked back through the archives and I was like, I have never actually made this episode. I just like talk about this concept so much in coaching contexts and especially actually in my teaching contexts, whether it's like, you know, workshops that I'm doing, keynotes with a Q&A at the end, that kind of thing. And also sort of my formal teaching work associated with the university, so teaching medical students, teaching residents. This is like the thing that like, if they do a rotation with me, if you are a learner and you want to come do a rotation with me, this will be the thing that I invite you to prioritize when you are seeing patients. And I think it's not a unique concept. I did not make up this concept. The concept is the Fife questions from the patient-centered clinical method, the patient-centered interview method. Like, this is classic bread and butter ways of learning to connect with patients that I learned in my residency, that many people learn in like medical school and residency. But I think sometimes the way it's framed, like, gets a bit lost in the shuffle. And so that's why it is so important to me to like highlight and center all of the benefits of these questions in our lives, both with patients for sure, in patient encounters, whether those are happening in the hospital, in the emergency room, and in clinical setting, like wherever they're happening, these are your magic gold questions. But also like in the rest of life, these are just great questions to always be thinking about, actually. And so, I feel like when I first learned them, and I am going to explain what they are to you if you actually, you know, either you haven't done medical training or your medical education did not use this particular acronym or you haven't learned this concept, I'm going to explain it all. But I think it's helpful to frame what sort of happened to the five questions, at least for me. And this is in no way like a critique or a dig at any particular person who taught me. I think it's about sort of the general vibe, the hidden curriculum of the medical culture, like kind of once again. And also like my conditioning of being trained, even like pre-entering medical school, I'm just always wanting to like do things in the most correct way, in the fastest way. All the ideas we carry with us about what a proper doctor is supposed to act like, how a proper patient encounter is supposed to go, which is that, you know, all through medical training, when you would practice on patients, the thing that they would really emphasize, which is an important thing to learn, of course, is like how to take a history and do a physical exam so that you can like solve the mystery of what's happening for the patient in that room. And so then the focus is really on like making sure you ask all the right questions and get the pertinent positives or negatives and kind of have your Sherlock Holmes hat on and be really like investigating what's happening to this like body in front of you. And sometimes it can almost feel like that, where it's sort of like they're a body, you're picturing their anatomy, but you're not really picturing that they're a person as well, right? And that's what the patient-centered clinical method, I think, is trying to, my understanding of it is that's what it's trying to sort of recenter is, so, you know, as clinicians, we stop speaking of people by their body parts, where you're like, oh yeah, the appendectomy down the hall in room 5, like, it's, you know, Joe Smith, and who happens to be in for appendicitis, like, kind of recentering the fact that these are humans that we're treating. And so that makes really good sense to me. I hope it does to you. And what that kind of meant in terms of how I ingested being trained to not only be taking a history, but also be asking these, like, patient-centered Fife questions, is that it was sort of like the bonus extra. Like, the base package that meant you were a good clinician is if you took a good history and tried to solve the mystery of the body. And if you wanted to, like, have this extra credit badge of also having good bedside manner and being a nice person, then you tack on the Fife questions. Of course, like, in the way I was trained to be a family physician, that's not the case, in the sense that in our exam, we're literally tested on if we ask the Fife questions, if we get the patient context. And so, I mean, like, listen, the education system is doing their best to be like, no, this is a priority too. And yet, like, it was so interesting. I think back on, like, how myself and my fellow, like, learners, we would, like, always be really diligent and try and get the history and the, like, medical mystery solving piece of it. And then we'd be like, oh, right, we got to ask those Fife questions. And then we just, like, check them off the list, like, ask them one at a time. But, like, I certainly at that time didn't really ingest, like, that they were equally, if not more, helpful to me in the role I'm playing. I felt like I was doing it more as a performance, as sort of like to check the boxes. And that played out because, like, you know, after residency, as I started locuming and, like, seeing patients, I definitely the Fife questions would be the first thing to go out the window, because I'd be so anxious about, like, okay, but, like, what's happening in this room, and how can I, like, figure out what's happening here, and how do I stay on time, and how do I move on to the next patient? I must ask more questions. I must try to get to the plan quicker, you know. And then I'd be so frustrated when there would be times where the patient would be like, actually, I have 5 more things to talk about right at the end. Or I would feel like I got a good sense of what they wanted to talk about, but the patients were still, like, deeply, like, confused and dissatisfied at my excellent management plan that I thought was totally what they wanted. And all of that would take up so much time and energy, and I get so annoyed at these patients. Like, why weren't they just, like, acting like OSCE patients and just saying, well, thank you for your wonderful plan, see you later? Like, they had all these opinions and expectations, and I was getting thrown off in encounters with them and feeling more confused by them. And so that's where, like, along my journey post-educational, post-graduation, it really has become so clear to me that the Fife questions are not only, like, make you a nicer doctor. Like, I don't know, maybe some people would be offended by these questions. Maybe someone would be like, whoa, why are you asking me so much? Like, someone might perceive you as more or less nice, maybe, asking these questions. I have no idea. It's not about, like, being the best clinician or the nicest clinician. Honestly, the way that I frame them, that I'm hoping helps the next generation of learners that I'm teaching to, like, really consider them essential, is I'm calling them the best time-saving questions. Because if there's one thing that gets clinicians' attention, folks in healthcare, is, like, wanting more time, because everyone's running behind. There's never enough time in appointments. It's always frustrating when you feel trapped in the room or trapped in the ward with a patient that you only wanted to talk to for 15 minutes, and here you are 45 minutes later, right? So what there are a number of skills, actually, that can help you really guide and facilitate a conversation to be held within a certain time container. Knowing that holding it in a time container doesn't make you, like, the winner or something, but it's just a useful skill to know how to land a conversation in a time frame you were hoping to. You know, whether you choose to or not is fine, but, like, to, like, learn the skill of how to do that is very helpful. One of the other skills that's helpful with that is something I've talked about in a previous podcast that I know a lot of you really liked, which was, like, compassionate and collaborative interrupting of patients. And so this, I would say that, like, learning how to interrupt and sort of lead a conversation in a collaborative way, including sort of taking back the mic from a patient, that is a very helpful essential skill. to help you save time in patient encounters. But these questions, the Fife questions, if you start off your encounters with those, and say you're actually halfway through and you realize you haven't asked them and you're like getting into the swamp, I mean, ask them whenever you want, but asking them as early in the encounter as possible has been one of my best hacks, if you will, one of my best strategies for appointments to feel timely, time-boundaried, and satisfying to me, and in higher likelihood of being satisfying to the patients. What the patient has going on in terms of their thoughts and feelings is really in their domain, but there are things that we can be doing, ironically, usually, that also benefit us and feel satisfying to us, that end up feeling more satisfying to our patients, because we're not actually like opposing forces where only one gets to win. Actually, the win-wins are more common than you think. So that's why, that's my preamble to talk about the Fife questions. So, okay, I'm finally going to say, what are the Fife questions? So Fife, so it's an acronym, because you know we love an acronym in medical education and like sciences in general. So F-I-F-E. So the classic order, because of, you know, the way that that spells out and makes it a kind of a word. I think Fife is a real word, isn't it? I'm not going to look it up, but I think it is. excuse me. So the first F stands for feelings, which is like eliciting the feelings that the patient has, inviting the patient, elicit seems a little too extractive, I just realized, like inviting the patient to share what their feelings are about what's going on for them. So, you know, they come in, they have stomach pain. And so feelings are questions of exploring like, so how do you feel about the fact that you still have this stomach pain? How do you feel emotionally about your stomach pain, and really understanding the emotional impact of whatever is going on in their body on themselves. So that's feelings, the first F. The second letter is I, and that stands for ideas. So that's getting a sense of cognitively, what are their ideas, their theories, their hypotheses about what could be happening with said stomach pain. Because as you know, like if you've, I have a whole episode about Dr. Google, especially these days, it's like my neighbor said that their cousin had stomach pain just like this, and then they dropped dead 2 days later. So that person has very different ideas about their stomach pain than someone who's like, you know, I read an article about what they're putting in our water and I'm worried it's that, or like, I don't know, or maybe their idea is like, I think this is an ulcer. I had one 10 years ago and it feels exactly the same. Like, that those are very interesting, useful things to know, even if you're not going to like agree with their idea, and also it doesn't match your idea, that's okay. But like getting a sense of their ideas, that is the purpose of the second question. The third question, which is the second F, is function. So how are these symptoms, how is whatever's happening in their body and their change in their body processes actually impacting their function, impacting their daily life, like what's the experience they're having of it. There's this very useful delineation in the patient-centered clinical method of like the disease process versus the illness experience. You know, so the disease process, maybe like you're looking at the cells and you're seeing some of them are breaking down, and like that's the disease process and sort of the symptoms associated with that. But then people can be having the same disease process. They could all be diagnosed with the same condition and even have similar severity technically when you look at the tests. But people's illness experience, their experience of having that disease, can be wildly different for a multitude of reasons, right? And so getting an understanding of how the disease is impacting their function and therefore their experience can be extremely helpful. And the fourth questions are about expectations. So what is it that the patient is expecting from me, from this visit, from the healthcare system as a whole, right? So those are the Fife questions. And I hope even in saying them out loud, it makes sense why they would be useful questions to ask. So the thing I would say is the order of priority, I find. I do not ask every single one of these questions to every patient. One thing I've started doing, though, sort of actually just totally negating what I just said, is that I do ask all of these questions to each of my patients, but not with my mouth. Instead, I have it set up like through my EMR that each patient, when they book an appointment, I think it's the day before, they get like an appointment reminder email, and attached to it is a questionnaire that I slightly modified off of the original Fife questions, but it asks them these questions. Not every patient even sees the email. Certainly not every patient responds. Sometimes it's like a one word answer and a lot of like NA because they don't feel like they want to share, or they don't really see the relevance of the questions. But sometimes you get a whole essay. And I know sometimes people think like, oh, great, now I've got to read that essay. But to me, it is very helpful to see, even before I've started talking to the patients, the person who's given me the essay and all the worries they have and all the things they've done versus the person who's like, I'm just here for a physio note. Like, obviously, I'll double check if that's still the vibes going into the room. But I know that it helps me kind of budget my energy and have a sense of what I'm walking into. Depending on what they've written, those two people, we're going to have quite a different conversation. Even again, maybe they're both for back pain, but depending on what they've written, the conversation is going to go completely differently, right? So I do actually ask all of these questions to my patients in that way. But in the appointment, I do not, like in any kind of robotic or rote way, go through and ask like F-I-F-E. So I kind of wanted to talk practically in a bit more detail about how I prioritize these questions. And this is a bit of like also how I teach learners to think about them and what works for me, especially like around the framing of saving you time, saving your patient time, actually, sure. Saving time while preserving patient connection. And the reason that I think it's important to preserve patient connection is like, I mean, the fundamental bit of like, that's what we're here for. That is how often we're perceived as being helpful to patients. Like there's sort of the qualities that maybe seem obvious, or like, oh, it must be nice to do that, or that makes me a good or nice clinician. I just want to like put those to the side though, and just talk about like how pragmatically preserving patient connection, the connection between me and them, feels so much better to me, means that I have more energy through my day, especially the kind of connection I'm talking about, which isn't some sort of weird codependent strained connection, but like genuine, interdependent, honoring each other's humanity. Like that is the fuel that gets me through my day, that makes me love my job so much. So like that is one of the reasons I want to maintain the connection, is because it feels better to me. I also see over time it fosters trust. Like speaking kind of long-term time saving, the more I can do this sort of upfront trust building, connection building, the less likely the patient is to be like going to a zillion other doctors or coming to me a zillion times unhappy with my answer, if I've sort of established a connection via these questions from the start. So it's got those sort of long-term time saving implications. And then in the visit, truly, like something that I don't know if I've said it on a podcast, I've definitely like written it on Instagram, is like, if you want to be the most efficient with your time in a visit, it's not about finding the perfect like pertinent positive and negatives to ask. It's not about rushing and interrupting the patient without them having their space to be heard. Like those are ways, I suppose, you could like zip through an encounter. And I know it's a method that a lot of people use in healthcare, thinking it's the only way they can. But really, if you want to be as efficient as you can with your time, think of a Venn diagram. So there's the circle that contains everything that the patient is hoping that you can talk about and hoping that can be addressed and all of that. And then there's your circle, which is everything that you are hoping and willing and have capacity for and is even like within your expertise for to do in that visit. And so what you do, I'm showing it with my hands if you're listening, is looking for the overlap, you know, the Venn diagram, and only spending time on the things where they overlap. So not spending time all through the whole circle of everything the patient might want to talk about. No, that's sort of the boundary setting of, this is what's within my capacity, this is what's within my scope. I still hear out everything you want to talk about, but the thing we're going to focus on in the visit is the place where we overlap. Maybe that seems extremely obvious, but it took me a long time to figure that out. So I'm sharing my hard-earned wisdom with you of not trying to bring a bunch of my agendas into the room that the patient has no interest about and babbling on about that for forever. And also not thinking the only way it can be like a nice doctor is by somehow addressing every single concern that this patient has, including things I have no expertise or desire or capacity to hold in a given visit. We focus in on where they overlap. The only way we can know what overlaps is if we first ask these five questions to fully understand what the patient's circle is when they bring it into the room. That's why they're time saving. That's what helps you avoid, not completely, because humans take a while to, patients may not fully honestly answer the questions because they've been socialized to think that their needs and expectations aren't important or they've forgotten. Like it's not perfect, but it absolutely has significantly reduced the times I walk out of a room and then the patient's like, "Oh, I actually have five more things," which is everyone's pet peeve, including for the patient, I'm sure. They're like, "Oh no, I'm so sorry." And it has definitely also reduced the chance of like getting to an end of encounter and being like, I feel like we've been talking past each other this entire time. Like, what is happening? I'm still confused. I feel like there are elephants in this room that I'm not understanding. That has been like a major shift. So I'm going to go through how I like really use these questions and like the priority of how I found them to be effective for me. I would love to hear from any of you who want to share if there's different ways that you formulate these questions. Like, how do you actually ask them? Of course, you can just ask them by being like, what are your feelings about this? What are your ideas about this? How is this impacting your function? What are your expectations for today's visit? Like, those are nice, straightforward questions. You can ask them just like that. I'm a bit more like wordy and probably like slightly over elaborate. That's why I have a whole podcast. And so sometimes I have slightly different language that feels a bit more natural to me. And one thing I say to learners is like, try out something. It's going to feel awkward. And then each time you practice, you can kind of shift the language into something that feels more like authentic, like you're actually asking it from you versus because you've been told to. And you do that like by practicing it over time, right? So for me, if you ask none of these questions except for one, the one that in my opinion is the most time saving and most helpful is actually the last question in Fife, expectations. I mean, a mismatch of expectations is in some ways the root of every conflict, every issue that comes up. It is the thing that we are in a constant tug of war with our patients and can lead to so much burnout if we're not aware that that's what's happening. And so getting all of the expectations on the table from the jump is only helpful. Even if you're aware that you are unlikely or cannot, depending on what the expectation is, meet it, it is still helpful to have it in the room, you know? And so like even if it seems like a really straightforward encounter, it's like a diabetes visit or like blood pressure check and something, you're like, this will be straightforward. That assumption can sink you so hard and just like blow up in your face so hard. So forgetting to ask about the patient's expectations for the visit is the thing I've regretted the most. Like, that's the one I'm most likely to kick myself for not doing at the end when there's all the by the ways that come up. So the way I usually do it, so I usually sit down and ask like, what can I help you with today? Which is already like a subtle like expectation shift of like, I'm not like, how's it going? Every so often I'm like, how's it going? And then I often regret that because then they tell me all about how's it going, which is fine, but that's not technically what we're here for, right? We're here to say what can we do together today? So I often really focus in and ask like an opening question, something like that. Like, what are you hoping we can accomplish together today? That's another one I like to use, right? That has some subtle expectation setting on my behalf of like, we're going to focus on what we can do today together. And then, they'll start sharing some of their things. And I let them share for a little while. And then I often will get like an impulse to start asking more questions about the original concern. And like, I've learned to like wait for myself to feel the desire to have that question asked. So I've clearly let them talk for some period of time. And then I'll say something like, okay, that sounds like definitely I have more questions. I want to hear more about that. Before we dive into that, I want to know, if there's anything else that you were also hoping we could talk about today so we can kind of plan our time together. Something like that. We can plan our work. We can plan to, we can see how much of that we can accomplish, you know. And sometimes people pull out the list, the physical list or the list on their phone. Often if they have a long list, I'll say, okay, could you just briefly read out each of the topics and I'll write them down. Like there's different ways depending on how it flows from there. But it is, I really try hard to make sure I do that agenda setting. And sometimes I've started calling it agenda setting. Like it's sort of funny. We think we can't use these words. Like when you're in a meeting, like someone's, here's the meeting's agenda and here's everything we're going to talk about. Why not actually just verbally say that to your patient? We are in a meeting, you and I, patient, for the next 15 to 30 minutes. Let's set an agenda. Like, in some ways, let's just be more straightforward about these things. Of like, okay, so I'm hearing that on your agenda, you would love if we could talk about this and this and this. I'm thinking that in order to do that with enough time and enough attention on my part, we may need to only focus on one of these things and we can tee up some stuff for the rest. Like, so you can start sharing back expectations that the patient can have of you that are more accurate of like how it's going to go, right? So when you are socialized to be conflict averse and people pleasy, it can feel really hard to sort of take charge, if you will, or like step into a leadership role in these encounters. And it is a skill that will serve you so, so well. If you feel like you wobble with this, if you struggle to have the confidence to be the leader in encounters, that's okay. I think depending on how you were raised, what your past schooling was like, some schooling and some environments as we grow up honor the fact our leadership skills more than others and honor our leadership skills in different ways, right? But I would say this is just the most helpful sort of set of skills to learn is how to grow in your sense of being a confident leader and like leading your patient through an encounter in a collaborative way that includes their expectations and is populated from their agenda. But like really you being the one to facilitate it, it's so, so helpful. And I guess that's the last thing I'd say. Like say you walked into the room and you think you have a bunch of expectations of how the visit's going to go. Really double checking how many, if any of them, are absolutely essential versus things that you think you have to do in order to be perceived as a good doctor, either by the patient themselves and by outside bodies. So, you know, in primary care, there's a zillion things that I could always be adding to an agenda of a visit. And we're kind of trained to do that and like praise for thinking that's the most amazing thing of like every time the patient comes in with a concern, also check when their preventative health screening is due, also check what vaccines they are due. Excuse me. Also check like what medications are needing to be renewed. And there's some amount of that if there's space in the visit, if actually the concerns they brought haven't taken the whole time, I think about addressing that secondarily. But if I'm coming in hot with all of those things off the jump, it just means that then I'm more likely to get into like conflict, power struggle, expectation struggle with the patients, when really the patient's the one that booked the appointment. They're the ones like centering their agenda first gives them then the bandwidth to consider any additional items I want to add at the end. So yeah, those are the main things I want to say about expectations. And I would love to know for each of these, what you think of that, if you agree, disagree, what's worked for you, what hasn't worked for you. Yes. Like I think if you ask no history questions, if you ask like almost no other questions, but you at least get a full sense of their expectations, you're going to be able to have a productive and fruitful conversation where you're on the same page about what you're even talking about. And so it's just so essential to start there. Otherwise, you're talking across purposes and you can give like a beautiful TED Talk answer about whatever, the pathophysiology of the condition they have, and you've completely missed the boat. It's just so sad how often you hear patients experiencing that. And I say it's sad for the patients because it is. And it's also sad for those clinicians who like want to do a good job, that want to feel effective at their work and are missing the opportunity to actually be more effective at their work, you know? So that's everything I want to say about expectations. In terms of the second question, I find like second most helpful, they're all helpful, but this is the order. If they're easily answering the first of these, then I get into the second and third of these, you know. The second one I ask is ideas. This one I feel like patients is probably the one that patients, this one and the feelings one are the ones that patients maybe get most sort of befuddled by or more likely to be taken aback by. And I just, that's okay. So I just hold space for like, it's okay if you don't have any ideas. I often say that. I'm like, I'm just curious to know if you have any ideas about what these symptoms could mean or what's going on. Just because sometimes patients do, like I kind of do that normalizing thing of like, sometimes patients have done a lot of research or they've heard from a friend or they've come up with some ideas or theories themselves. And I'm curious if you have, like I say, it's something like that. And that helps temper their sense of it. But even when I say that, a lot of times patients are like, I don't know, you're the doctor, I have no ideas. And I'm like, no problem, I'm here with ideas too. I think sometimes when you get that reaction back, then especially again, if you think you perceive that as sort of like a conflict, which I definitely used to in the past and part of me still does, it's like, oh no, that was, I shouldn't have asked that question. But like, it's actually still useful information to know that they don't have any ideas. Like that is also useful information, right? It would lead me to potentially be more explicit and explain my ideas more because they don't have some of their own, right? So, and also, maybe they secretly have ideas, but they're very unused to being asked that question. And so sometimes, even if they say, I don't know, you're just a doctor, later on in the encounter, they say, you know, I was kind of wondering, I'm a little nervous that it could be cancer. You know, like it pops up later in the encounter. That's great. That's perfect. We've planted the seeds early so they have time to bloom. And often the patients have really interesting ideas. One thing to note is, you know, sometimes when they bring in ideas and they have a very firm idea, that can create that kind of anchoring bias where then I can get very focused on only that idea too. So that's part of my work is to say, that's a cool idea. It sounds like a real potential possibility. Let's explore some others just to confirm there aren't any other solid possibilities of what could be going on. And I'm saying this in my head and I'm often saying this out loud to the patient again. So I'm not dismissing or negating their idea. I'm saying a yes and to their idea and saying, let's explore some others just so that I'm on the same page of being extra clear that your idea is the most likely or one of the most likely, and we're not missing that something else could additionally be going on, right? So I kind of talk like that, and I find that that is generally well received, and I get some good connection as well as some information out of that. And the more recent addition that I've been adding in, and I decided to add it in this context to the ideas one because I think it fits best there, is in keeping with my work that I've been doing around embodiment, getting to know my body as a person and my friend and my constant companion. And this is also a little plug for the other podcast that I've started producing with my friend and former coach, Jamie Lee Finch, which is called Experiential Anatomy. Something that we actually just recently discussed on a future podcast was this thing I'm doing more and experimenting more with patients, which is asking them what they think their body is telling them through these symptoms. So in some ways, like I've started to frame it as like, you know, one way to think about these symptoms that are arising, one way to think about all of this discomfort and pain is that your body is trying to say something to you. I know that might be a weird question. Like I often will, whether I need to or not, I'm still prefacing it like that way. It's like, this might seem like a strange question, but if we think about these symptoms as a way that your body's trying to tell you something, what are some of your ideas about what your body could be trying to tell you? Y'all, every time I actually think to ask it, and it's funny because it's still a new question. So sometimes it flows away from my awareness and flows back in. But the answers I get are so fascinating and have so much insight and actually can leave me some really interesting discoveries in terms of giving me new ideas of like, oh, I didn't think about, that's interesting. Maybe there is something there, you know? And even if it doesn't reveal anything new to me diagnostically, it absolutely reveals more to me, like in relationship to that person and having a better understanding of that patient's relationship to their body. And that is so helpful, both in that encounter in terms of how I'm framing and explaining, you know, maybe what I'm suggesting they do next, and also just longer term. I think that's really therapeutic work to have people start to consider that when their bodies are feeling a different kind of way, that is their body's signaling something to them. That is their body talking to them, and considering making that a bit of a bi-directional conversation. It's been extremely helpful in my life. I have a hypothesis that it would really greatly help to reduce the increasing burden of health anxiety and illness anxiety on patients as well as on the healthcare system. And so that's one way I kind of seed that idea. Speaking of ideas, I'm seeding an idea of like, what if your body's talking to you? What if your body is trying to communicate something helpful to you? What would it be? And I kind of would put that in the ideas category. And I've really enjoyed that question. So something to try out if you've never tried that question before. Especially, I would say, like, I probably use it less in like something that seems like a straightforward strep throat, but like in something where someone keeps coming back chronic, you know, multifactorial, undifferentiated, no obvious diagnosis, have done a bunch of tests. These kind of questions for those encounters, extremely helpful to at least like shift the conversation to something new, you know, and to give some levels of insight that I actually think are therapeutic insight for the patient themselves. So that's what I wanted to say about ideas. For function, I think function is a really practical question. I think we think of it as like, I feel like I would always put it as extra, like goes in like, you know, the social history, the IADLs, like it's just sort of like, oh yeah, this person is a human that exists in a context of their life. So I guess that these things could be impacting their life. And so it feels like extra, but really it's your best triage question. Because if someone's like bopping through their life and they're saying it's 10 out of 10 pain and it's all of this, and then you ask them like, how's this impacting their lives? And they're still going to work and they're still doing other activities. Then you can have a conversation about like, help me understand 10 out of 10 and still being functional and what that means to them. So not in a like gotcha way, but like, that's going to be a different conversation than someone's like, I'm saying my pain is 3 out of 10 and I've completely let go of everything that is important to me and I cannot get out of bed. You know, like in some ways, function and the impact on function and how much their function has been impacted by the illness is a more effective triage question than like having people rate their pain, in my opinion. And so, and it also therapeutically with the patient helps them to have a place where they feel seen, that like this is real, their illness experience matters, like those sorts of validating experiences are helpful for patients and for all humans actually. And so a really useful question that way. I don't have a ton to say about function, but like that, I would say those are the reasons why that those sorts of questions. And so I say it's something like, how are these symptoms impacting you in your day-to-day life? Like a classic way. I feel like I learned it that way. Something like that. As well as say they just share some of that with me, I often will like, so say they're like, I can't even walk up the stairs. Like those are the moments that I are more likely to offer like a empathetic, like reflective, like, wow, that sounds so challenging. I'm hearing how much this is impacting your life. Like I will prioritize to reflect back those pieces over maybe like, I'm hearing you say it's in your left shoulder. Like the what I often want to make sure they know I've heard is the impact it's had on them. I do think that's a way for patients to have a better likelihood of feeling like we're taking them seriously. I'm not in charge of what they think of me. It's not about trying to manipulate them, but like, I find that that is a pattern of talking with them that often opens the door for them to relax into like, okay, this is a person that believes me and understands what's happening to me. And a relaxed patient that is trusting you, just way more effective, time saving stuff, like more likely to listen and participate and collaborate on a plan, follow through on that plan, right? Like these are time saving measures, not nice making measures, time saving. Okay. I'm trying to emphasize how helpful they are. And then the last set of questions is the feelings questions. I find these ones can be really tricky, like maybe even more so than the ideas one. I'm still exploring ways to ask this question where people feel open to sharing. I think because many people have been deeply socialized to ignore their feelings, think their feelings don't matter, think that sharing their feelings is weakness, embarrassing, shameful, right? So asking it out the bat, probably my feelings questions are the least likely to get like a full and honest, transparent answer. And that's okay. It's still planting the seed that I care about their feelings. Sometimes saying like, how do you feel about this? People are like, literally like, what do you mean? Or like, they don't know how to answer it. Sometimes I get slightly more, a higher chance of like a response that gets close is like, is there anything that's worrying you about this problem? Or is like, are these symptoms stressing you out? I find like stress is like a gateway word that allows people to talk about their feelings in a way that like emotions and feelings sometimes aren't, because emotions and feelings have been so just like maligned and stigmatized in our society. So sometimes like, are you finding these symptoms stressful at all? That can lead people to share then like, yeah, I'm like, I'm worrying about it. I can't stop thinking about it. Or like, oh no, I'm happy to have them. I don't know. Like, you know, so sometimes saying, is this stressful for you? And asking just a question, not assuming it must be stressful, but like, I find that can be like a sneaky way to ask the feelings questions. And then another way is like, you know, I have a lot of patients where if they were to have symptoms like yours, they could feel really scared or worried or feel guilt or shame about it. Like, I think about patients who have been through similar situations, and I'm not assuming that this person will have the same emotions, but I want to leave the door open in case that happens. Like, a classic one that's coming to my head is like someone going through a miscarriage. Like, I often will say like, you know, going through a miscarriage is something that can bring up a lot of hard feelings. I know I've had patients who would blame themselves. I have patients who would feel guilty. I have patients who would feel very, very sad. And I would have patients who feel happy and then feel guilty about that. Or, you know, like I kind of name a few different things that I've seen. And like, is any of this the case for you? And it's fine if it's not any of those, right? But trying to like leave the door open and normalize by sharing in an anonymous, amalgamated way, of course, like the experience of other patients I've seen, that's been a helpful way to get it through. And like, even just say that that question doesn't lead anywhere, just like as the conversation is going on and when they bring up emotions, like naming and reflecting those back and validating. Like if nothing else, like, you know, when people are talking about the impact on their lives and how much something's like hurting them or bothering them, like something just as simple, like validation statements, like, whew, that sounds like a lot, you know, that sounds like you've got a lot going on, you know, like just try like something just like, wow, like really just reflecting, you know, the intensity of the experience they're having back to them again in that validation way, not because it makes me nice or good, but because building those alliances truly are the best way to save time. I'm gonna keep bringing it back to that. Like, I'm doing it because it feels good to be in good connection with patients. And I'm just aware of people listening. Sometimes it's like, it's nice that you feel good, but I can't prioritize feeling good when I've got 50 patients waiting for me. So the thing that's fun is, even for the 50 patients waiting, even for I'm running an hour behind, I don't have time to validate your feelings, the best way to catch up on your time, the best way to save time in this encounter that you feel like you don't have enough time for, are these questions. Isn't that fun? That's my favorite, how it all actually ties together. And the inhuman story is that taking the time to talk about feelings and expectations and ideas and function is a waste of time. No. If anything, I wonder if some of the pertinent positives or negatives not are a waste of time. They're just like lower yield, in my opinion. This is my opinion. You can have another opinion. In my experience, that has helped a whole lot more than if I remembered the random question that led to the rare diagnosis. That's probably not what's going on anyway, you know? I'm not against taking a thorough history. I just think that this kind of thorough history has gotten me way farther than memorizing the specific rare signs of specific rare things to make it like a prettier history that gets me more points on the OSCE, you know? The last thing I wanted to say is that actually in that like questionnaire I send out to patients, I have a bonus question, which I haven't so much asked people in person, though sometimes I do, especially in sort of mental health kind of coaching and counseling appointments I have. And that's the question of celebrations. So I have like space for patients to write in when they're filling out the questionnaire ahead of time of like, is there anything that you want to celebrate with Dr. Chan when you see her? And it's so fun what they put in the box, and I get to like name it if it feels right for the thing, and we get to have this moment of celebration. Because oftentimes, you know, people are bringing in their problems, they're bringing in their stress, they're bringing in their struggle, and that's important to hold space for. That's what this entire podcast has been about. But there's sort of an and there of like, we can focus so much on that that what we pay attention to grows. And so I love giving people the opportunity to also celebrate what they've overcome, what they've done for themselves. It's an empowering kind of move to have them celebrate, you know, what they feel good about, and it brings a different energy into the room. So that's my like bonus question, which I don't know if it's time saving or not, but it's a good time. So sometimes it's just when you're having a good time, that's also a kind of time saving, because misery slows you down so much, right? So that's it. That's finally, I have recorded this. Finally, I can share this. Like, I'm probably going to share this episode with learners, like before they come and work with me. So then, because otherwise I've been sort of doing a version of the spiel with each of them, which is fun too. But this way they can listen on their own time. So hi, future learners. Thanks for coming and doing electives or places with me. And for everyone else who will never be my learner because, you know, you're already graduated and out in the world, I would love to hear if you have a different approach, if you found different questions to be helpful, and if you're like, okay, fine, I'll like, I learned those in school, but I've never tried them, and then you actually give them a try, I would love to hear the results of your experiments in actually incorporating these questions and prioritizing these questions into your encounters. And if you notice a difference or not, I'm open to being wrong 100% of the time if you're not aware. So I'd love to hear what comes up for you as you try on these questions for yourself. And with that, I hope you have a fabulous week, and I'll talk to you next time. I would love to take this work deeper with you. Visit joanchanmd.com today and discover my growing menu of options for restorative medical education to suit your learning needs. I offer one-on-one coaching, customized workshops, and self-study courses that allow you to connect not only with my work on a deeper level, but also with other healthcare humans just like you. So if you want to start humanizing your work in healthcare to a deeper level and do it in community with others, please visit joanchanmd.com and find those options and what fits you and your life today.